you cannot be on this planet and not see the stories today of Christians being killed because of their faith.
You know, it is a very dangerous time to be a Christian. Torture, beheadings, destruction
of... the highest level of persecution of Christians.
A church congregation barricading themselves in from hundreds of riot police.
Christians are enduring attacks for their faith like
never
before.
Along with the savage kidnappings of Christian schoolgirls in Nigeria by Boko Haram and the burning of Christian
images
churches.
Of violence dominate headlines.
21 Christian men beheaded by Islamic State.
The title of the video is a message signed with blood to the nation of
we
the cross.
Seen the sharpest jump in violent attacks against Christians.
Just because you're murdered, does that mean you become a martyr? I think there's a sense that a martyr is somebody that has been put to death because their death is the result of their faith. And that could include Christians today in the Middle East.
Sobering thoughts. Welcome to another edition of Come Receive the Light with Father Christopher Metropoulos, and I'm Mike Trout. We want to start a new month of programming emphasis with this broadcast. We'll be talking about commitment, sacrifice, and martyrdom. Thank you for joining us today. If you're not familiar with Come Receive the Light, we are just one of many ministries from the Orthodox Christian Network dedicated to presenting the good news of the Bible and looking through the lens of the Orthodox Christian faith at all the world around us. We're a nonprofit outreach, and we're on the web at myocn.net. That's myocn.net. Before we begin our feature conversation, Father Chris has recorded a quick discussion about something that has brought peace and joy to millions of people for thousands of years, music.
We have with us today Mark Powell from Cappella Romana, a professional vocal ensemble that performs early and contemporary sacred classical music in the Christian traditions of the East and West. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I think the first question is... tell us about Cappella Romana. What does that mean?
Cappella Romana officially means Roman Chapel. And the reason we have that name is that we explore music from the Roman inheritance, both from Old Rome and the Western tradition, but perhaps more importantly, for most of our work, New Rome, which is Constantinople. Mm-hmm. The Christians who lived in the Byzantine Empire referred to themselves as Romans, not as Greeks, actually. So this name encompasses the Christian tradition from both East and West.
Now, I understand your newest album is Good Friday in Jerusalem, and it's on sale now. What makes this album different from any other Holy Week album? We've had so many of them out there.
This is probably the first recording ever made of chants that are included in the special ritual of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre, or as we call it as Orthodox, the Church of the Resurrection of the Anastasis, had a special typikon, if you will, a special way of worshiping. And it varied from other major centers in the ancient world. It had its own special way of doing things. And on the occasion of Holy Friday and of Easter, of Pascha, the services took on a very special quality in that they took place throughout the whole city. So there were stations throughout the city where the pilgrims and the faithful and the clergy and so on would go to a particular place and sing hymns and have prayers in locations that were known to be where Jesus, you know, experienced his passion and his death and resurrection.
Now, these are all in English, correct?
No, the chants are in the original Greek.
Okay. I marvel, frankly, I've been a priest now 35 years, and I marvel during the times, of course, on Holy Friday when we listen to these magnificent hymns as they're chanted. And many of the people know the hymns, but they have no idea what they're talking about. And
yeah.
Once you start to read these hymns, and you not only read, sing, and then pray the hymns, it opens up a whole new dimension on Good Friday, doesn't it?
Yes, definitely. And we provide full text and translations in all of our materials, along with a scholarly article by our founder and artistic director, Alexander Lingus, to explore the full context of this music.
Now, I know Cappella Romana performs in Oregon, Washington, in that area, but you also tour. So tell us a little bit about some of the tours you've done.
Sure. Just recently, we gave a concert of Greek Orthodox chant and choral works at Trinity Wall Street for their 12th Night Festival in New York City. Mm-hmm. That happened in early January. Coming up in March, we have a tour in the South with performances in Charlotte, North Carolina, and in Atlanta, Georgia.
Well, hopefully those people out there will let us know through our social media. We can get the word out for you. They'll have more and more people there. How can our listeners purchase your album?
There are two ways, principally. It's distributed worldwide, so you can buy through Amazon.com, you can buy from CapellaRomana.org, or any one of the download sites as well, on iTunes and so on.
Excellent. Very good. Are there any samples that you could allow us to listen to?
Sure. Actually, one of the most interesting, and I think for contemporary Orthodox people, is to hear the famous hymn Simeron Kremata, which is the today he who hung the earth upon the waters is hung upon a tree. This is Antiphon 15 from the service of Matins that we do today. So one of the hymns here is sung not to the melody that we know today, but to its original medieval tune. And so it gives listeners a chance to hear how this music would have sounded at an earlier time.
Well, I'm afraid we only have time for that much of this beautiful selection. St. Ambrose of Milan once said, in part, "A religious hymn is a great blessing for everyone. The voice sings the soul's joy." Mark Powell said Cappella Romana will be on tour in March this month. They'll be in Charlotte, North Carolina on the 13th and in Atlanta, Georgia on the 14th. Details can be found on their website at CapellaRomana.org, or we'll have a link to that information on our website at MyOCN.net. And if you link to Amazon.com through our website, anything you order generates a donation to this ministry. Go to MyOCN.net, click on our bookstore link, and order any of Cappella Romana's music and help support OCN all at the same time. Again, the website, MyOCN.net. American patriot Patrick Henry, while speaking in church on a Sunday morning in 1775, famously said, "Give me liberty or give me death." And he was willing to die for a cause, independence from British rule. Is there a cause you would die for? Let me ratchet that question up a big notch. Are you willing to die for your faith? Ponder that as Father Chris talks with Dr. James Skedros, the Dean of Holy Cross Theological Seminary and Professor of both Byzantine Studies and Early Christianity. And the topic is martyrdom.
Welcome, Dr. Skedros.
Thank you very much.
May I call you Jim, James?
Please. No, Jim is fine.
Jim is fine. Okay. You cannot be on this planet and not see the stories today of Christians being killed because of their faith. In the last year alone, we are told through our research that millions have lost their lives and entire towns have been completely wiped out. They have been given the title of martyr in the news and among the faithful. How did Christians understand the word martyr or witness in the early church is what we're going to talk about today. Did it always refer to someone who was killed because of their beliefs? Let's talk about that, Jim.
Sure. So the word martyr, Greek word martis, has a bunch of different derivatives or Yeah, the different forms, let's say in the New Testament in particular, there's the verb to give witness. There's the word martis itself, which in the New Testament context usually has the meaning of witness. There's another noun, martirion, which could also be another word for witness. So there's a bunch of different words, but the word shows up a lot in the New Testament. And, you know, maybe the best example is the one that comes early in the book of Acts, where Luke is, you know, writing his second book, the book of Acts, after the gospel, and he begins talking, he begins with Jesus right before the ascension, and that, you know, Jesus says, you know, after I ascend, I'm going to send my Holy Spirit to you disciples. And he says, very interestingly, he calls these disciples, you shall become my witnesses, martires. You will become my witnesses. In other words, and you will spread the gospel to all of Judea, Samaria, and he even says, unto the ends of the earth. And so this is followed up. This term witness is picked up elsewhere in the New Testament. In Hebrews, in the book of Hebrews, for example, after Paul, if he's the author, tradition says he's the author, after Hebrews 11, where he's talked a lot about Old Testament figures, he begins in chapter 12, and he says, we have this amazing, referring back to all the Old Testament folk that he just referred to, Moses, etc., we have this amazing and famous phrase, cloud of witnesses, in Hebrews 12:1. And that talks, again, the word is martires, which you and I now, because of 2,000 years of Christian history, automatically translate as martyr. It doesn't seem to have that quite of context yet of dying or meaning of dying for the faith. However, in the same book of Acts, when Luke is talking about Stephen and the martyrdom of Stephen, and he puts some words in Paul's mouth in chapter 22 in Acts, he calls, Paul is talking to the Jews in Jerusalem on the temple steps, and he says, you know, I've been persecuting you folks, and I was persecuting Jews all along, and even Stephen, the blood of Stephen, to martyros, the blood of Stephen of the martyr, or is it blood of Stephen the witness, or your witness? In other words, is Paul at this time thinking of Stephen in terms of someone who died for the faith because he is stoned by the fellow Jews, or is he still just a witness? But I would say for most of the New Testament period, the term has this sense of bearing witness, the message of God's gospel, of Christ's good news to the world.
So going off of what you just said, taking that a little bit further then, when did the church start using the term martyr to mean in defense or death in defense of the faith in connection with we use it a term which I don't necessarily know if it's correct, the canonization of the saints?
Right. So there's probably two things here I would say. First, probably by the early second, mid-second century, it's that word martis, or martyr, let's just say martyr now, begins to have the sense of somebody who has died for the faith. So by the time of St. Polycarp, who was a bishop of Smyrna in the second century, he dies, he's put to death in the 160s, if I remember correctly. His story gets written down, and that story was probably written shortly thereafter his martyrdom. And in the text itself, it mentions that the Christians would gather around the place where the body of the martyr, the body of the witness, that is Polycarp's body, was buried. They would gather once a year to commemorate him. The title of the text starts the Martyrion, the witness of St. Polycarp. So you could probably say, and he's a bishop that was burned to death at the stake, and so he is what you and I would start to consider as a classic martyr, someone that stood up for the faith and spoke in defense of the faith and wasn't going to give up his Christian identity. But even in the book of Revelation, you know, which is probably written maybe 50, 60 years earlier before the letter of Paul, or the martyrdom of Polycarp, there's this interesting reference in the book of Revelation to the blood of the martyrs. In Revelation 17, you know, and that the great whore of Babylon is said to be drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. Mm-hmm. And there's that word, is it the blood of witness? Is it the blood of the witnesses or martyrs? But remember, the book of Revelation is written in the context of persecution.
Right.
Most likely Domitian persecution. So now we're in a different context than perhaps you know, when Luke is writing Acts, when he's using that term, Martes martyr. So I would say by end, beginning of the second century, mid-second century, that term witness now is really getting associated with people who have died for the faith. Now, the question of canonization, I don't know if I should go on to that.
Yeah, go on to that, because people use canonization. Recently,
right.
We have several saints that have been declared canonized or become saints through the ecumenical patriarchate. And I've heard sort of a debate. You know, we don't necessarily use the term canonization.
Right.
The Roman Catholic Church does. Can you clarify
right.
that a bit for us?
Sure. So the term we use in the Orthodox Church is either in the Russian tradition, they say glorification. In the Greek tradition, we say recognition. So, anagnorisis, we recognize somebody as a saint. In the Russian church, I don't know the Russian word, but they use the term glorification.
Okay.
And so you're right to say that the Orthodox tend not to use that term canonization. It suggests a bit more structural, legalistic approach. And the Orthodox church, you know, we do have, you know, there are processes that local churches do have for, you know, for lack of a better term, vetting somebody for sainthood. It's not really the appropriate term, but nonetheless, there are processes, but they're not as rigid or as hard and fast as you might find in the Roman Catholic tradition. But let's go to the 4th century, for example, you know, the great age of the fathers, the Cappadocian fathers, mm-hmm. and a little later, St. John Chrysostom. You know, these great fathers, St. Basil, Gregory the Theologian, St. Gregory of Nyssa, St. John Chrysostom, these guys who wrote heavy theological treatises that we all read today also delivered remarkable, passionate sermons on the feast day of martyrs.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, how did the church decide that St. Babylas, for example, that Chrysostom gives a sermon, and we have that sermon, the martyr Babylas, that he delivered in Antioch, how is it that the church decided that that person should be recognized as a saint and commemorated on this liturgical calendar? Or Gregory of Nyssa, who writes a remarkable sermon on St. Theodore Tiron, and he delivers this compassionate sermon and exhorting the faithful to go and wrap their arms around the coffin where the bones of St. Theodore are, as if you were embracing the martyr himself. Where did the church decide, oh, St. Theodore should be recognized as a martyr? There was no process in the early church. It was basically recognition out of tradition that, oh, we know this person has died for the faith. We know Polycarp was a bishop, and we saw him murdered. We saw him killed because he didn't deny Christ, and he refused to sacrifice, and we're going to remember him. And it's interesting, if you look at the ascetic tradition in the Orthodox Church, in the desert tradition, St. Athanasius, who writes the life of St. Anthony, picks up on this beautifully when he writes the life of St. Anthony. Now, Anthony is living in the 300s, and he dies in the 350s, 360s. So the age of persecution has ended, but he uses an interesting phrase. He says, Anthony was in his cell daily martyring his conscience.
Okay.
So the physical martyrdom had left, but now it's the spiritual martyrdom
that
replaced that.
Talk to us briefly about how does dying for the Christian faith prove to be a witness of that faith?
I think Christ said that, you know, you will lay down your life for someone else, and that someone else oftentimes can be and is Christ himself. And Christ told us that when you give water to someone who's thirsty, you've given water to me. And so by laying down your life for someone else, or you're laying down for Christ, but laying down your life for Christ, it's a witness. You know, the question is, it's an age-old question that Christians have struggled with from the very beginning. And Christianity is born on the soil of persecution from the very beginning,
mm-hmm.
Unlike other religious traditions. You know, and talking about Islam today in the Middle East, where, you know, Christians are now suffering extensively, and whether it's at the sword of Islam or not, that's a debate one can have. But the early history of Islam was not really one that Muslims suffered on the sword, but we have a history of that as Christians. And so I'm not, because I grew up in America, but our history is one that we've had this dilemma. Do we remain Christian and pay the price? Do we keep our faith quiet? and just move along. You know, the church, it's interesting, never has said you should go out and look for martyrdom. In a certain sense, the church has said, don't seek martyrdom. And this is very clear in the early mm-hmm. church.
Yes.
That, because there were, you know, a lot of martyrs, and the message was to the faithful, you don't go out and look for martyrdom. If it comes to you, fine, but you don't look for it. So it's not something we're running out to look for.
Very different from the Muslims of Islam who want right. to be martyrs. Is that what I'm understanding here?
Yeah. So yeah, and I'm not. Yeah, I mean,
there's
no tradition in the Christian Church, at least in the Orthodox Church, where you know, I will go die for the faith
right.
and then become a martyr.
Right.
Even the Western Crusader movement, there was this notion that if you die as a crusader, you know, your sins are forgiven and you'll mm-hmm. essentially go straight to heaven.
Right.
You don't find that in any of the military writings or anything like that in the Orthodox tradition.
Thank God.
Thank God for that one. I mean, you could say that there's, we're passive in that sense, but that's our witness.
Okay.
It's been our witness throughout history.
All right. We've used the term a few times today, passion bearer. So give us a brief definition of new martyr, nail martyr, passion bearer. Those are terms that we kind of use
sure.
usually within the Orthodox Church, but the average person may not even know what that means.
Sure. So a passion bearer is the two most famous passion bearers are Saints Boris and Gleb from the early 11th century. And that is somebody who doesn't resist evil with evil. Hmm. So you may be confronted. Let's say, for example, you're confronted and you by some evil person, or you're attacked or something, and you could respond with evil,
mm-hmm.
But out of your love for that other person that's hurting you, you may say, "I'm not going to fight," and you have suffered. You have suffered a passion. You know, you've suffered passion. You've borne it in Christian humility and love.
Okay.
Neo-martyrs are martyrs who have been put to death during the Ottoman period. And you can use that term even today, maybe even talk about martyrs in the 20th century as neo-martyrs in 21st century. But it's usually a term that's reserved for a collection of martyrs that were put to death under the Turkish Ottoman period. And we have those stories were collected for us most famously by St. Nicodemus of Mount Athos, who collected many of those stories, and others have been added to in the 19th century. And the remarkable stories of bravery of Christians who were, you know, being persecuted either economically, socially, etc., under the Turks, and stood up for their faith. And one very interesting story that recurs is that, let's say, a Christian during the Turkish period became Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on in life wanted to renounce his or her Muslim belief and go back to be a Christian. They would tend to go back to the same spot where they had made their public confession to be a Muslim, and then make a public confession that they are now Christian. The church would recognize that, and then usually that would result in some sort of arrest and eventual death, because it was illegal to apostatize from Islam. So once you'd become a Muslim and you went back to be a Christian, that was basically a death penalty for you.
Well, this has been a fantastic conversation, enlightening to say the least. I'm thinking of all the saints over and over. I read them on a card every Sunday at the liturgy with my associate, Father John. And I'm just wondering, are there martyred saints that the church doesn't know anything about?
Yes, I would imagine there must be. Just like there are holy people that you and I have known in our lives, that we would say, that person's definitely a saint,
mm-hmm.
then the church may never recognize that person officially as a saint. But I would say that, you know, we could make the case that we've met many saints, unofficially seen as saints. And I would say that the same is probably true for martyrs. The difference is that martyrdom is such an ugly thing, and that death is such the way of martyrdom is such an ugly reality, that we might have a better chance of knowing those people that have died that way, but we might not. So the Soviet Union is probably a very good example of that. We may never know exactly how many people were put to death because they were simply Christian or refused to reject their Christian faith. And I would imagine there were people like that in the early church as well, and people today in the Middle East.
Jim, thank you for being with us today.
It was my pleasure.
This will be our topic all month long here on Come Receive the Light as we move through the month of March. And I hope you can join us. We'll also be featuring articles on our blog site, The Sounding, and other resources that touch on this subject. Our website again is myocn.net. That's myocn.net. I've mentioned several times we're a nonprofit organization. You can become a financial partner with us. Join in this outreach in that way. Simply go to the website, click on the Donate Now button, and open up a world of opportunities for you to participate with us. That's myocn.net. Do join us next week if you can. Our host each week is Father Christopher Metropoulos. I'm Mike Trout, and please remember to always have faith in what you listen to.